Hello there, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, 2010, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge.
I'm sorry, don't I know you?
One would hope, because I'm your host. That's savagely scintillating sexologist Dr. Dick. I have some absolutely fascinating sex wisdom in store for you today. This is just the second installment in this new podcast series. We're all about connecting with some of the movers and shakers in the field of human sexuality. We're talking to researchers, educators, clinicians, pundits, and philosophers who are making news and reshaping how we look at our sexual selves. My guest today is Mark Zidler. He's a sex historian, don't you know? And he's here to help us demythologize some of our culture's sexual taboos. He believes, as do I, that once we have a historical perspective, we are less likely to be manipulated by those who want to keep us from the truth. This is very interesting stuff, sex fans, so please stay tuned.
Are you Jack Walsh?
No, I'm not Jack Walsh. I'm Dr. Dick. I just said that. Now, Mark invites us to visit him on his site, thebacchanalian.com. And there we can explore themes like alternative lifestyles, erotica, adult humor, taboos, and the history of sex. This week's podcast sponsor is Eden Fantasies, the one-stop place to shop for the very best in adult products.
Do I detect some kind of sarcasm here?
No, you don't detect any, because I'm serious. You'll find a full line of quality sex toys, fetish kits, sexy lingerie at Eden Fantasies, but that's not what makes our sponsors so damn special. What makes them so extraordinary is their social conscience, and that, my friends, makes all the difference in the world to a sex-positive guy like me. The Eden Fantasies site is chock-full of tips for the conscientious consumer, practical user guides, and toy reviews, as well as their wonderful community blog, EdenCafe.com. I want to make sure that you check out the Eden Cafe site. It's so fun and sexy, irreverent, and downright naughty, but it's also exceptionally informative. Look for the Eden Fantasies banner right there in the sidebar of DrDickSexAdvice.com, and you can link through to the Eden Cafe from there. Okay, on with the show. Welcome, Mark, and thank you for dropping by DrDickSexAdvice.com. I'm so delighted that you are here to share with us your very own brand of sex wisdom. You're only the second person to join us for this new series, so I'm very eager to get to the meat of things with you as quickly as possible. But before we do that, would you like to say hello to the nice people?
Well, hello, nice people.
And they are nice people, except the really pervy ones, and they're nice too, in a different sort of way. So listen, I've been traipsing through your online world for hours on end, and I confess to being absolutely mesmerized by what I find there, so maybe that's the very best place for us to start this conversation. You write about your website, thebacchanalian.com. Sex is an amazing part of human nature that touches the core of our being and gives us the opportunity to lose ourselves in mind-blowing bliss and ecstasy. On the other hand, sex can be unpredictable and difficult to handle without running into countless barriers. Sex is a taboo subject laden with much danger, and therein lies my fascination with it. This is a blog about sex that will primarily explore themes like alternative lifestyles, erotica, adult humor, taboos, and the history of sex. That's a mouthful, don't you know? So how did you decide on becoming a sexual historian?
Well, I've always enjoyed history. I started out studying all kinds of different types of history: European history, classical civilization, history in Mesoamerica. But wow. I always found the social history very, very fascinating. History of people's lives, and actually what know, more than just dates and names, but what does the history actually mean? That's what I find really intriguing about history. And as you know, I went through all kinds of different types of history and really delved into it. One thing that I begin to find, you know, you start reading about various taboos or beliefs people have, and I found some really interesting things about a lot of the sexual taboos, you know, and what they're based on, and
right.
You know, myths, and you know, which may have made sense in one time, really, yeah, not that
they
relevant.
They were intended to instruct and to, you know, cohese the society, and sometimes, you know, they go out of style. They go out of, they lose their meaning. Is that not true?
Yeah, that's right. But there's a momentum behind them, and people do things. You know, well, my parents taught me it's this way, and then well, I don't know any better, so I'm going to teach my kids. I mean,
right.
That's all I know.
Right.
And this goes on for generation after generation,
yeah.
And in some cases, some of these beliefs have persisted for a couple thousand years, and we really don't know why we
right.
believe them.
Yeah. And even though they don't serve us particularly well, we just, you know, continue to promulgate them, which just seems really counterintuitive, but, you know, that's the way us humans are, it seems to me.
Well, creatures of habit.
Right, exactly that. And sometimes even if the habit is deleterious to our health or well-being.
Exactly. So, you know, one of the main themes of my blog is I want to explore these different taboos, well, sexual taboos in particular, and just really debunk them,
mm-hmm.
show them why, you know, they really aren't relevant, you know, to help take the power out of them in people's lives,
right.
so that you know, they can make real decisions about, you know, what they want to do with
exactly.
their sexuality.
A laudable task, I might add. I feel like I do a lot of the same thing, you know, in the work that I do, is, you know, helping people demythologize the things that are getting in the way of happy, healthy involvements with other human beings and themselves.
Yes, it is. It is challenging.
Right. So tell us about how you came to name your blog.
Yeah, the Bacchanalian, it's not exactly the most common name that you might hear of, but I think it fits really really well. But essentially, you know, the name of my blog was inspired by the devotees of the cult of Bacchus, who celebrated their devotion to him in the wild and mystical rites of the Bacchanalia.
And we, at least some of us, it seems to me, myself included, maybe laboring under a misconception of what the word Bacchanalia means. Sometimes, or the thing that jumps to my mind is, like, you know, wild, crazy, extravagant, orgiastic sex parties.
Exactly. I mean, this the connotation that this word has. It really has to do with the excess. You know,
uh-huh.
Well, drunken free for all,
right.
Orgies, gorging on food. This is really out of just being out of control. Not a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are some, you can say, sanitized modern versions of this.
Uh-huh.
If you'll go around to lots of, like, very large cities around the world, you will find at least one restaurant named the Bacchanalia.
Uh-huh.
Where they have a style of food based on, you know, they have a nice wine and more, you know, Italian food or Greek food, something along those lines. Or there's even these wine tasting societies, because, you know, Bacchus is also the god of wine.
Mm-hmm.
People have formed these wine tasting societies, so they get together and everyone has a good time trying different wines, but, you know, nothing too crazy. But if you really take away all these meanings that we have today about the Bacchanalia, what it is at its core, they were free-spirited and sexually charged festivals that involve pagan mysticism, group sex, divine communion, which allowed its celebrants to achieve states of euphoria that hovered between divine ecstasy and the oblivion of nothingness.
Wow.
This was a religious festival,
mm-hmm.
and yes, it did include sexuality, but this was sacred sexuality.
Well, a lot of ancient traditions, including Judaism, had sacred prostitution and sacred sexuality. So it's not completely known.
Or India, they have many traditions.
Yes.
Tantra and Kama Sutra is also another example of sacred sexuality, and it can be very profound.
Mm-hmm. So why did you choose this as the metaphor for what you wanted to talk about on your blog?
Well, with my blog, besides debunking these taboos, I want to promote the free expression of sexuality. I believe when people can freely express their sexuality, it makes our society healthier and stronger. But we have many voices that say otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Religion,
mm-hmm.
Organized religion,
mm-hmm.
They'll say Judeo-Christian uh-huh. religions say otherwise. They argue that free sexual expression is bad and will cause the breakdown of society and even mm-hmm. the collapse of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
But
they're not alone in that. I mean, the medical industry does the same thing, and legal industry codifies the laws to really stultify and concretize like exclusive sexual relations between a man and a woman.
Yeah, but I think all those things still originated from the Judeo-Christian dominance.
Right. That's true enough.
But the historical record really shows this is simply not the case. And in the history of the Bacchanalia, I think it shows this point quite nicely. Like I said, these were sexually charged spiritual festivals, which formed an integral part of ancient Greco-Roman civilization. It had lasted, these festivals were celebrated for nearly 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
This is longevity. 1,000 years. The world didn't come to an end, and it didn't cause chaos in society. It was people viewed this as a normal, acceptable thing.
Enshrined in the culture.
Enshrined in the culture, and people found fulfillment with it. And it's not something that people started up. It was going for 20 years, and then all hell broke loose. It's not like that.
Yeah. But something must have given it a bad rep, and you know what that is, right?
Oh, certainly. What had happened with the Bacchanalia is when it spread to Rome. It became very, very, very popular throughout the Italian peninsula in the Roman Roman Republic.
Uh-huh.
But essentially, what happened? It got some bad press. Every movement has some problems, but this particular bad press survived the fall of the Roman Empire.
Uh-huh.
Civilization descended into dark ages, and lots of information got lost. Well, this piece of bad information about the Bacchanalia just happened to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not really the true image of the Bacchanalia. And really, what had happened? There were several events. There's what I call the events of 186 BC.
Mm-hmm.
There's a set of laws, and I'll elaborate a little bit more. I call it the Lex Julia, and the writings of a politically biased historian. In 186, this is the time. Roman power was really starting to expand through the Mediterranean. They had already defeated Carthage, and lots of slaves and people from different cultures were coming into the Italian peninsula, and the Bacchanalia, the organization, they wanted to expand their membership, so they allowed people from all these different classes, slaves and foreigners, native Italians, equestrians, people. But the hierarchy was all female.
No kidding.
Yes.
well, we have to stamp that out right away.
Well, yeah, that was one problem. The other problem is the hierarchy of the Bacchanalia wasn't controlled by the Senate. And Rome is still a patriarchal society, and mm-hmm. the Senate didn't really take too kindly to that aspect, and the other aspect is the Bacchanalia was outside of their control. So they clamped down on it really hard. In 186 BC, they arrested the hierarchy and put the Bacchanalia under senatorial control. Like all religions in Rome at that time, we're under senatorial control. This was just something that was done. You know, mm-hmm. you could think of like every emperor of Rome is the Pontifex Maximus. You know, mm-hmm. he's the head of the of all the religions in Rome. So they felt very strongly about that. So this is a big event in the Bacchanalia's history, but it didn't put an end to it. It could still continue on. And, as time went on, it got rehabilitated. None other than Julius Caesar, he gave it a lot of state sanction and support during his dictatorship. And, from there, it became increasingly popular. You can even think of Mark Antony. I think we all know the story of Mark Antony and mm-hmm. Cleopatra. He was the most famous Bacchanalian there is. I mentioned the Lex Julia, and around the time Caesar Augustus was the emperor, he was the first emperor of Rome, he had an empire that sprawled all of it across the Mediterranean. It put a lot of stress on Italian society, and he felt that a lot of traditional Roman values were suffering. And so he felt it was necessary to do something about that. And lots of Roman citizens were, marriages didn't mean too much, committing adultery. So he instituted some very harsh anti-adultery laws, which is called the Lex Julia. A husband could even legally kill his wife if he was caught or she was caught committing adultery. So there are things along those lines. So into this environment, actually, by the way, like these laws, they were extremely unpopular with the
even in his own household.
His daughter.
I know.
Yeah, he banished her for adultery. I mean, he was quite humiliated by the whole affair. But that just this shows us how unpopular this legislation was with the Roman people.
Yeah.
They pretty much defied it and ignored it. But then during this time, you had this historian, Titus Livius, or we know him as Livy, and he wrote this very expansive history of the Roman Republic. And if you wanted to be a successful writer, you really had to toe the political line.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly wanted to be. And so he's writing this history, really to glorify the Republic and glorify traditional values. So when he wrote about the Bacchanalia, he didn't write very well of them at all. Actually, he wrote them out as a very despicable organization. People, they would... at their festivals, people would get murdered and people would disappear. This really dark view that he would write of it, because he had an agenda.
Mm-hmm. A political agenda.
A political agenda. He had his own career that he was thinking
right.
of too.
Right.
But of the literature that survived the fall of the Roman Empire and the Dark Ages, only 25% of his books survive, and the books about the Bacchanalia is one of them that survive.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the other writings about this festival had disappeared. And so when Rome fell, we only had this left, and mm-hmm. that is a story that... That got told. Now, fortunately, modern historians, they have a lot more resources available to them and can cross-reference a lot of literature. We've been able to figure out much better, get a much clearer picture of what was actually going on. And we know that this festival actually went on as long as it, almost a thousand years,
mm-hmm.
and was a very functional part of society. Even if you go to St. Augustine in the late 4th century, wrote about them. He certainly did like them, but and I suspect they lasted into the 5th, maybe even the 6th century, and then eventually just faded away with the ascendancy of Christianity.
So there's a message in this, is there not, that is applicable to our time, and that is that movements and people and sexual practices and sexual orientations can be demonized for political reasons, and that could be the downfall and the end of something that might have been a very happy, healthy sort of thing for a very long time.
Absolutely. I mean, in this particular case, it was a failed political policy of the Augustan regime that at its time mm-hmm. was virtually ignored, and
right.
then this actually was believed to be the truth.
Right. Yes.
And this is. Really the main theme of my blog. So many of these taboos that we believe come about maybe for very similar reasons, which have no relevance. There's no reason for us to believe that the Bacchanalia is this awful, hideous, horrible thing. But that's in the popular imagination. That's what it is.
That's
but
right.
It's not true.
Right. But as I think I understand from reading around your site, that there has been a resurgence, or to some degree anyhow, of the Bacchanalian tradition. And how did this come about?
Well, yeah, that's right. We had a little resurgence here in right here in the city of Calgary.
Get out! Really? No kidding.
Absolutely. Yeah, about 3 to 4 years ago, there's a bunch of women in the Calgary kink and swing community had organized an erotic goddess training.
Oh,
and
wow! How cool.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. It
you got to do something on those cold winter nights, don't you know?
Well, yeah. Oh, exactly. So this was a 6-week course. So one evening a week, these ladies would get together. There was about 10 women in this
uh-huh.
group, and the participants, they would learn about the ancient traditions of the goddess. Talk about various goddesses. I don't know a whole lot because it's all done in secret.
That's
my,
right.
My wife.
Yeah, and you're not a lady.
That's right. They were sworn to secrecy, but secrecy.
Uh-huh.
But what I was able to gather, there's lots of sensuality, a lot of eroticism, and it's hands-on experience.
Wow. How grand.
So it's definitely, it wasn't vanilla goddess training.
Right.
and I was always a very happy camper after Rihanna come home from one of these these meetings in the state she was in. It was very nice.
Mm-hmm. So Rihanna, your wife, was a participant in this revival.
Oh, she sure was, yeah. She saw this this being advertised at one of the local swing clubs in Calgary, and you read the intro, and she just had to go. You know, it's like there's
absolutely.
Just no way.
Absolutely.
It just called to her.
So it's interesting that you know this revival of sorts would be coming out of a relatively liberated sexual tradition, which is the swing tradition. Yes.
Oh yes, exactly, and you know, just exploring, you know, the roots of sexuality, sacred sexuality. You know, just what do the ancients think about this? Because we don't really have a whole lot to go on here.
But we do have a sense, at least I think we do, that we have a sense that sacred sexuality is female based.
Yes.
As opposed to male-based.
Yeah, we're pretty boring, aren't we?
And I think that there's no accident that there was. That's why you know the patriarchy tried to dissemble it, but always it went underground and would have these periodic resurgence throughout history, right?
Oh, for sure. And, well, I think we instinctively know, like, I mean, just the power of feminine sexuality is tremendous. And, organized religion, I think, subconsciously knows this and has to try to demonize this as much as possible to try to, you know, keep the women under control.
That's right. So, may we turn our attention now to another major theme of your site that kind of follows from what we've been talking about so far, and that is the Sin of Sodomy series. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Oh, I certainly can. It's a series where I explore the sin of sodomy based on the Sodom and Gomorrah narrative in the Bible. Now,
right.
There are several taboos on around that are on homosexuality, but the sin of sodomy is, I would say, the most insidious of them all. So I decided to explore this in my writing.
Right, and even to this day, or maybe especially in this day that we're so far away from the original sources about this, that you know, people think that the sin of sodomy had something to do with same-sex sexuality, which I think you and I both know is not true, right?
That's correct.
Your introduction to the Sin of Sodomy series is so spot on that I'd like to quote from it, if I may. Whenever the names of Sodom and Gomorrah get bandied about, the story of God's judgment against those doomed cities for the sin of sodomy usually comes to mind. No other story in the Bible is used more often to persecute homosexuals and promote homophobia than the account of Sodom and Gomorrah. The story of Sodom and Gomorrah's destruction has been incessantly used as a warning against anyone who tolerates or readily engages in homosexual behavior. Thomas Aquinas, the influential theologian and scholar of the Middle Ages, wrote that disasters of any kind could be possible as God punishes the wickedness of Sodom. Earthquakes, fire, plagues, floods, volcanic eruptions, storms, or even women falling into ditches could be interpreted as signs of God's wrathful vengeance against sodomy. This view was so entrenched within Christianity that it is still repeated today. Whenever a national tragedy occurs in the United States, popular Christian fundamentalists can be easily found loudly proclaiming the tragedy to be God's retribution against America for allowing homosexual sin. For example, after Hurricane Katrina slammed into New Orleans in September 2005, evangelist John Hagee said that all hurricanes are acts of God, because God controls the heavens. I believe that New Orleans had a level of sin that was offensive to God, and they were recipients of the judgment of God for that. The newspaper carried the story in our local area that was not carried nationally, that there was to be a homosexual parade there on the Monday that Katrina came. And the promise of the parade was that it was going to reach a level of sexuality never demonstrated before in any of the other gay pride parades. So I believe that the judgment of God is very real. I know that there are people who demur from that, but I believe that the Bible teaches us that when you violate the law of God, that God brings punishment, and sometimes before the day of judgment. And I believe that Hurricane Katrina was, in the fact, the judgment of God against the city of New Orleans. The views of Pastor Hagee may not necessarily represent the mainstream society. Their belief in God's judgment of homosexual sin is still a very potent force among many Christians. It is this belief that supports right-wing bigotry and gives voice to their visceral opposition to any extension of civil rights to gays and lesbians. The disturbing irony about the whole situation is that the story of Sodom and Gomorrah had initially nothing to do with homosexuality. Well, isn't that the truth? I mean, again, demonizing whole groups of people, and we have to admit that this is a political agenda here. I mean, same-sex sexuality has been with us as long as, you know, us humans have been around. And so something must have intervened, you know, brought about this really political decision to demonize this group of people for one reason or another.
Oh, absolutely. And it was a transition. It happened over a long period of time, right, in responses to different issues.
Right. And there seems to be a transition from Old Testament thinking or ancient Hebrew understanding of the Sodom and Gomorrah story and what happened and how that was manipulated by the Christians. Isn't that true?
Oh, absolutely. The original view within Judaism was that the sin of sodomy had nothing to do with homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And if you go look at the narrative, we would find that actually the sins weren't clearly spelled out as to why God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, we're told that in the story that God hated their wickedness. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it's not very clear. And then there's one key moment in the narrative where, you know, Lot's house is surrounded by all these sodomites who want to get a look at the angels that came to visit, and they, mm-hmm, quote unquote wanted to know them. Mm-hmm. When the Christians read this, they assume that is to take them outside and have homosexual sex with them.
Although Lot, you know, offered his virgin daughters.
Yeah, and they weren't interested.
Yeah. And it didn't seem like that was a particularly terrible thing to do because women were chattel.
Oh, yes.
And virgin daughters, throw them to a bunch of, you know, sex-craved people. That seemed to be pretty okay with God.
Apparently. If we look a little deeper into this and actually look at, like, how this story was constructed, and this is the key, some key words in this whole narrative, to know. And the Hebrew word for to know is yada, which has a double meaning. Either like to actually know, to know someone, or to have sex. Mm-hmm. Now in the Old Testament, this word is used 943 times. 933 times it's used to know someone, and 10 times is used to in reference to sex, and it's all heterosexual sex. So
right,
it's really, really unlikely that these guys wanted to have sex with these angels.
Right.
know, and another way to look at it, you know, what did actually, you know, the Jewish, other Jewish writers think about this narrative? So we look for commentaries, and preferably commentaries as close to the time the Sodom and Gomorrah narrative was written. You know, Ezekiel, which is right in the Bible, he mentions greed and lack of hospitality as a reason for the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah.
So does Jesus, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely.
So it's an interesting kind of thing, because that's where a lot of the Christians, you know, pin their hopes on, you know, Jesus mentioned Sodom and Gomorrah, and so he must have been, you know, not down with the whole same-sex thing. But his interpretation of the sin of sodomy was inhospitality.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, how the Christians turned that around to be inhospitable to whole groups of people. Listen, I'm really sorry, but our time is up for today, and obviously we're just getting started with this, and I have so many more questions for you about other things going on in your blog. Could I invite you back for next week?
Oh, for sure. I would love to come back.
Outstanding, outstanding, outstanding. But before we go today, could you give us your website address and walk us around a bit so we can visit you throughout the week?
I sure can. It's www.thebacchanalian, that's BACCHANALIAN.com.
Cool.
And when you come to the main page, you'll be greeted with there'll be a slider with the main, you know, some of the key posts on my site, and there'll be a bunch of teasers below that, and on to the one side there's a bunch of different topics that I've explored, and you can go look through them that way.
Cool. Outstanding. Listen, Mark, thank you so much for your precious time, and until next week, we will be seeing you in cyberspace.
Excellent.
Take care, kiddo.
Yeah,
bye.
Take care.
What a great show, huh? Tune in next week for part two of my interview with Mark Zidler and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Remember, this week's podcast sponsor is Eden Fantasies. EdenFantasies.com provides you a unique opportunity to shop and educate yourself about the amazing array of adult products out there. Of course, they uphold a high standard of quality in the toys they carry, but they are even more focused on customer service and consumer education, which makes Eden Fantasies, to my mind, the very best place to shop on the net.
Can't you take a joke?
Yes, I can. I also want to turn your attention to Eden Fantasy's brilliant new e-magazine called Sex Is. You'll find tantalizing articles and informed opinions on sex, society, health, erotica, and humor. You'll even find ways to green your sex life. And just in case you don't get a big enough dose of Dr. Dick here on DrDickSexAdvice.com, you'll find that I have an occasional column at Sex Is, too. It's called Dr. Dick on Demand. Look for the Sex Is banner in the sidebar of my site. One final thing. I want to make sure that you take a moment to check out my new product review site, DrDickSexToyReviews.com. That's right, sex fans. Now you can see what's hot and what's not in adult products. You'll find reviews of all sorts of adult goodies, sex toys for sure, but also condoms, lubes, fetish gear, as well as educational and enrichment videos. Don't miss a single one. Again, the address is DrDickSexToyReviews.com. And look for all of my podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section, obviously. Once there, all you have to do is search for Dr. Dick Sex Advice. And don't forget to subscribe. I wouldn't want you to miss even one episode. And hey, feel free to leave a comment when you do. Until next week, remember, sex is good. And good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.